Hello, listeners. This is Kevin Andrade sitting here with Rhode Island Democratic, well, candidate for the Democratic, not for the governor, Spencer Dickinson. Spencer,
hi. I am a candidate for governor, Democrat.
Yeah, thank you for being here with us. So first, I want you to tell us a little bit about yourself. What's your life history like?
Well, you know, one of the things that I've learned is that it's very important. This kind of pertains to the whole governor's race. You need to do an apprenticeship in everything. And you were telling me about your work, you know, for the newspaper in Fall River. And now you're here. I think the apprenticeship is important. And a lot of what I've done sort of fits into that category. I was in the Army for a couple of years, and it's a very difficult life, and it's hard to do, very worthwhile. I volunteered. Extremely valuable. I'd recommend it to anybody in terms of...
What time period was this?
We're talking 60s.
Okay, so
it was a long time ago. It was during the Vietnam War.
Did you go?
I did not deploy in Vietnam. So I was, but that, on the other hand, you know, since you asked, I was with the 5th Mechanized Division, which was an extremely, you know, impressive thing for me to see and be a part of. And our job was to, in effect, deploy to Europe with tanks, tracked artillery, APCs, etc. And it's like taking the town of Wakefield, and every ranch house is a tracked vehicle, and it moves to Providence, and every resident of the city of the town of Wakefield is a troop between the age of 19 and 42, and they all show up, and they could move. And it was very impressive to me to be a part of that organization. And, you know, it's a long time ago, but what I'll say is I learned from it.
Yeah.
And, you know, you don't necessarily prepare yourself for something. You're not thinking, well, I'm going to run for governor many years from now. But after that, I worked as a systems analyst programmer for Prudential Insurance in Boston. I felt that was something that was coming, and it was something I should know about. And it's really up. And then I went and did the same job again at Citizens Bank of Providence. And, you know, a total of several years of that job. What you learn is how a large organization works and where the little glitches happen and how they go wrong. And essentially, your job is to find them, fix them, and get them back on track. And we have some of those problems in the state today. To be honest, I enjoyed that work. It was very satisfying and very challenging, but I didn't like being in the cubicle, so I kind of reverted back to other work I had done, and I decided to be a home builder and a contractor, and I did all kinds of contracting work. And interesting little point, when I was, you know, I guess I'd been into it several years, but a friend of mine was working very hard against the Rome Point power plant, which was a big issue at that time. And he said, could you build a solar heated house and sell it on spec? And I said, sure, just give me some plans. Well, there were no plans. There was no such thing as a solar panel. And so I said, but, you know, I promised to do it. I drew the plans. And you didn't know, was it possible to bring in enough heat off the roof to balance the heat that's required to heat the house? You know, there's millions of gallons of fuel that can be saved, and, you know, get rid of the need for the power plant if you can do this. So I built the first solar panel. We tested it with a chart recorder. We put it up. We built the house to match the input and output of heat. It worked. First one worked. And then the business got very good. I started selling that product, which is a package of components, to other builders. And I had a very busy several years doing that. Along the way, I got elected to the legislature.
Could you just remind people what district that was?
Well, at the time, my first time I was elected, it was Exeter, North Kingstown, and Jamestown, a huge, probably the biggest district in the state. And the first time I ran, I knocked on just about every door in that district. And you see everything that there is when you knock on every door at Exeter. And very educational, but very satisfying also. And we had some, you know, and then later in 2010, I ran again, got elected, and a whole different situation. Had some problems with Gina Raimondo and Gordon Fox at that point. But I think, you know, the theme that I'm trying to make, to get into here, is that there's an apprenticeship that's involved with what you do. And whether it's as a contractor or a legislator or, say, somebody that solves problems in business, like a systems analyst, you have to start low enough down to see what really is happening. You have to be willing to see it at the grassroots level. And that was one of the huge benefits I got from being elected to the legislature. The interesting thing, I'm very proud of it, that when I was first elected, we had no open records. And as a reporter, that might interest you. There was no such thing as open records. You couldn't go to the town hall and say, I have the right to see this. You didn't have that right. We did not have recorded voting. We didn't have campaign finance. You could, you didn't have to tell anybody where the money came from or, how you spent it. We didn't have ethics, which is essentially explaining where your interests are, where you might have a conflict of interest. And in a very short time, we changed the leadership of the legislature, and we adopted, and that was myself and a small group of other people who got this thing going. And I remember when I first walked in there and sat down in the back row, I thought, this stuff that I think we need, this will take 50 years. And that's a kid talking. We had it in 4 years. So there's a tremendous sense of satisfaction. And, of course, I think I got elected. I had myself and my wife, living in half of a two-family house. And by the time 8 years had gone by, I had 4 kids. And it's kind of tough to live on $300 a year.
Yeah, I can imagine.
It cuts into your business. Part of the background of that whole experience, I had a conversation with some teachers, particularly, maybe a union leader, and he said, you shouldn't be in the pension plan. Legislators in those days got a pension, and that sort of made up for the $300. He said, you don't belong in that pension plan because you're not contributing enough. You can't contribute enough out of a $300 salary, and you're going to be cutting into somebody's future, the value of the future pension. You shouldn't do it. I said, well, of course, I was a kid, and I didn't know any better, and I didn't think I'd ever live long enough to see a pension, let alone care about it. So I opted out. I didn't do it. There were two total, if I remember right, who weren't in the pension plan. But I point that out because I've cared about the pension plan for a long time, and that's one of the important issues I'm dealing with today.
Yeah.
But we're off the track of friendship thing.
You brought up an interesting issue. You brought up that as a legislator at the time, you were living off of $300 a year.
Right.
You were married. So
Of course, I'm not living off of $300 a year. I'm working. Yeah. It's supposedly a part-time job, but if you're doing it right, it's a half-time job, which might mean that overall, you're going to have to do 1.5 jobs because your job. I had a business. I had people work for me, and I was very proud of my business being a contractor. I paid Blue Cross to every single employee that I ever had.
Yeah. So over the recently, and by recently I mean over the past 4 or 5 years, we've seen a rise in people talk about living wage. We need to raise the minimum wage up to $15 so that people who have minimum wage jobs can actually live off of that funding. Many people say that will hurt small businesses. How do you feel about such a stand?
Well, I think we should do that, and I think that now's the time to do it. I mean, you have to time some of these things. And somebody says, well, gee, why can't we make it like $100? Well, no, 15 is a realistic number. But the point is that now's the time to do it when the economy's strong. And something important, a lot of people don't understand the economics of this. If you bring your business to Rhode Island, and maybe it's nothing, maybe it's something as simple as a hamburger stand, a Burger King, and your competition is somebody else who has a similar business next door, you're competing, and maybe you'd like to pay your people a minimum wage of $15, but your competitor's not doing it. So by making the minimum wage, you can be proud of the fact that you're paying the $15, and you're competitors also paying $15. So, in effect, it works in the economy, and it gives you a chance to do something you probably want to do anyway, but without the unfair competition of your neighbor doing something different.
So, which brings us to
Is the economics of it.
Right. Which brings us to another point that you bring up on your website, which is your position on healthcare and public options. So many people feel that a public option would just be too expensive on a national scale, never mind a Rhode Island scale. But there are also people on it who say I'm a living, breathing human being. I deserve to be treated for health issues. You have pointed to examples of France as a model for universal health care, right?
Yes.
So could you just explain a little bit about your views on that?
And by the way, just in case anybody's wondering, my daughter is married to a Français, a French man who's an engineer. She met him in Brooklyn. All Rhode Island kids go to Brooklyn, and then they might meet somebody they married. And she's expecting twins, and she's being taken very good care of by the healthcare system.
Well, congratulations on the twins.
Thank you. It'll be soon, I hope. But France and Canada, you know, there's a lot of discussion about this. It works. Mm-hmm. But the important point to keep in mind, you know, and I refer back to the fact that when I had employees, and I had, you know, maybe 8, 10, 12, everybody got Blue Cross because that's the right thing. And that, you know, I paid the whole thing. You wouldn't do less if you cared about your employees. Mm-hmm. Today, it's difficult. But the thing is that if you look at the economics of it, our healthcare system probably costs half again or 40% again as much as it should. Another way of saying that is if we went to a universal healthcare system, some of the big profits in the insurance business would go away, some of the big costs in pharmacy mm-hmm. would go away, some huge administrative costs that hospitals and doctors have to put up with would go away. So we would save 30%. Mm-hmm. Now, where the money comes from, is it a payroll tax? You know, that's something that we're going to have to work out. It's going to be very mm-hmm. different. But if we somehow could get that worked out, you know, you and I would pay 30% less, which means that, and this is a huge part of our economy. So we are, in effect, churning money into our economy that is, mm-hmm. You could call it wasted. Mm-hmm. And if you've got, say, 30 clerks in a hospital, they could be technologists and nurses and doctors mm-hmm. because maybe what they're doing, pushing paper around, isn't really that productive. And if you go to Canada and look at the same hospital where you see 30 clerks, here you see 3 in Canada, which means opportunity. You know, maybe they're paid better, maybe they have a different job, but there's much less waste. Getting there is going to be really, really difficult mm-hmm. because we've gone so far down the road of entrenching the system that we have. Mm-hmm. And my thought about that is that...
And when you say system we have, are you referring to the Affordable Care Act? Or are you referring
well,
to
that's the, included in it.
All right. Yeah.
What we have includes extremely complex requirements for clerical work, mm-hmm. Pharmacy, lots of profit, and administrative costs in insurance, mm-hmm. Which probably isn't really an essential part of what makes you and me, you know, get the health care we need.
Right. And so you feel that the state should have a role in health care?
I think that the time will come, and is it 5 years, 10 years, 30, 40, who knows? This is, you know, it's coming mm-hmm. Because we cannot afford for it to get more and more expensive, and we can't afford 30% of our health care budget to go mm-hmm. into something other than health care. That's what we have now. The road to arriving at that is difficult. This country is huge. Rhode Island might be a small test case. I think it's going to be very hard mm-hmm. to isolate one state. But, you know, I think it's worth a shot. And as governor, I would allocate the resources of the administration, mm-hmm. which includes the insurance commissioner and anybody else that seems to have something to contribute, and I would ask them to show, you know, figure this out. Mm-hmm. It might require hearings, might require some looking into what people are doing in other places. But we need a roadmap to get us there. Mm-hmm. You don't just impose a payroll tax, you know, next week and expect mm-hmm. it to work. That's not going to work. Mm-hmm. So it might have to be gradual, but I'm predicting it's one of those things. I look to the future and I see it. So why not benefit sooner instead of later? Mm-hmm.
So one issue that you have been really, really swinging away at, which we were talking about slightly before we started this interview, is the Boroughville power plant. You've been critical of it. Two questions are, just explain a little bit about what your position is on the Boroughville power plant. And many people say that, but the Boroughville power plant will create jobs. Do you think that environmental concerns would trump economic concerns?
Well, let me, you know, the answer to the first part of your question. Yeah. If you elect me governor, there will be no power plant in mm-hmm. Burrillville. No new fracked gas power plant in Burrillville.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the reasons are not that simple. There's almost like a war going on between people out west and in Chicago who want to extend and expand the electrical grid.
Mm-hmm.
And they see something coming here, and this is one of their ways to block it, because we have the potential for offshore wind, which is going to be a huge source of power for us. In addition, it's already happening. People are putting up solar farms mm-hmm. all over the state, and you're starting to see Mark DePasquale with his wind towers. You know, and something very important, you know, 10 years ago you couldn't pick up the phone and order a wind tower. Today you can. You know, you might have zoning issues.
Yeah.
But you can have these, they exist. We can have as many as we want. And when we do, we're going to have a huge source of energy. It's going to mm-hmm. change our economy. And, you know, this is a huge plus. If we go to a very high percentage of alternative energy, you know, one of the important fact I just want to point out as a footnote, we are spending $4 billion a year now on, in effect, importing fossil fuel energy. And that's like a boxcar full of money leaving this state with $4 billion in it. And there was an economist who, named Jane Jacobs. She was a very mm-hmm. famous city planner and economist, and she wrote several books. And a somewhat controversial point that she made was, although I agree with her, if you begin to produce a product that you used to have to buy from somebody else, that improves your economy.
Mm-hmm.
So if we begin to not need fossil fuel energy coming into our state, then we're going to, you know, we're going to be much better off because we're going to produce it ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the people who run the national grid and who basically love to sell fuel, such as anybody in Texas, they don't want us to do this. So one of the ways to block it is to flood the market with the alternative product, whether we need it or not. And if you look at the, you know, some of the auctioning that, that the electric company does to determine its power sources,
mm-hmm.
we don't really need this power plant. But if the power plant is built, it's going to cost $1 billion. That $1 billion is going to have to be put on the backs of the ratepayers,
mm-hmm.
and it's going to block the development, or at least slow down the development of offshore wind and onshore wind towers and solar farms. So there's a battle going on here. We're the battleground. So add to, you know, then that doesn't even take into account the dangers of global warming. And, you know, we were, a few years ago, we were talking about, we've already seen 10 inches in the last 50 years of rising water in mm-hmm. Narragansett Bay or on the wharf in Newport, or pick a place. And we're expecting now, scientists are telling us it's going to be 4 feet. And you can be a climate denier and say that's not happening. It's happening. And, you know, just go down and talk to the city planner in Newport and let them show you on the wharf, or pick a town, you know, Wickford, Jamestown. Towns like Wickford are going to be underwater. Now, this is going to happen. So the question is, can we stop it at a 4 foot rise? It's a serious problem. And it's a very dangerous problem. New York City, you know, now one of the fairly responsible numbers is like 7 to 9 feet. I think that might be maybe worse than is really going to happen. But if we had 7 to 9 feet sea level rise in, you know, by the end of this century, and I'm not saying I'm going to be here to see it, but, you know, my grandchildren still might, New York City is going to be underwater. And we're going to have to bring a whole lot of Dutch engineers over here to build, mm-hmm. you know, seawalls for us. They're going to be really busy. And we can't build. And then you got poorer countries like Indonesia, or countries where you have rice paddies and, you know, mm-hmm. That kind of an economy. They are suffering already because the 10 inches has really put them underwater, mm-hmm. changed everything. Look at a map of South Florida, the southern third of Florida, or look at flyovers of beautiful real estate, and you can see that people have, you know, say docks and seawalls, lots of people, because mm-hmm. there's a lot of waterfront down there. And you can look. You can see what would happen if the sea level went up just 2 feet. Billions of dollars of South Florida real estate is going to become unmarketable just in the next few years. This is serious. Now, humans don't tend to take things seriously. I think that's our nature. And people like me, and, you know, I don't know, I'm not sure what the right name for it is, but, you know, I think ahead and I worry about this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes people are going to laugh at you, but there's more and more of us that are understanding that this is serious. Why it seems to be something that Democrats understand and Republicans don't, I can't explain that.
So there's two spin-off questions off of that statement. First one is, I kind of came prepared with it because I'm researching for this. I stumbled across it.
Well, you're allowed to ask me anything, okay?
But by the way, I want to point out that Mr. Dickinson, when I asked him to do this interview, he did say, make sure you have tough questions. Al Jazeera English, I stumbled across an article of theirs, and they're known for having very strong environmental material.
We're talking now about a TV news show?
It's a website. Al Jazeera English?
Okay.
Yeah.
It's a website.
Yeah,
okay.
And it's based out of Qatar, and it's well-financed, and they're known for doing...
of Qatar, country. Okay.
Yes.
Yes, I
And they had an article about... Hawaii, it's a couple of years old now,
yeah.
But there's a program to expand solar panels over there, and they're finding that middle and upper income folk are purchasing that and coming off the power grid, and the costs of maintaining a power grid are shifting onto lower income people. Would you have any ideas of how to mitigate that? And secondly...
You always ask these two-part questions. Yeah. You know that puts a big strain on my brain.
That puts a big strain on mine, too, as well.
Okay, so I'm going to try to remember the fact that we got people in Hawaii going off the grid. And then the next part
And that's a possibility in Rhode Island as well. And secondly, what can the state of Rhode Island do to, if you become governor, to combat global warming?
Well, the question about Hawaii, I hadn't thought about or I'm not aware about Hawaii being, you know, the place where people are going off the grid. It sort of makes sense, though, when you think about it. I've never been there. And they're probably going off the grid because it's very good for, you know, it's economically smart for them. They got a lot of sunlight and they're ideally suited and probably getting the stuff out there costs a lot of money, you know, for a standard power system. So they can probably do just as well financially or make better by using, say, solar farms. The lower income, you know, that's something I'd need to think about. Of course, it's a problem. It's something to think about. I'm not sure that is the focus of the reasons for, say, not saving the planet from extinction. You know, I have a feeling we'll all be better off, whatever income level you are. And, you know, it's almost like pick something, ambulances, you know. I mean, they didn't used to exist. I'm pretty sure lower income people have benefited from the advent of the ambulance or the fire truck or, you know, pick anything. So I'd have to figure that out a little bit, but I don't really see that as an issue. So the rest of the question was, what should we do?
If you're governor of Rhode Island, what would you do in regards to that beyond not approving the Broville power plant?
Well, the key point is, and you know, it does sort of tie to the Broville power plant or anything like it, and people know this, but I just feel the need to say it. We are burning fossil fuel. This is warming the planet. I know a lot of scientists, and every time I meet a new scientist, I ask the question, is global warming real, and is human activity causing it? And they say that it is. And I'm not a scientist, but, you know, I follow along the arguments a little bit. I think they're right. So there's a strong motivation to do, you know, to build the alternative stuff. And as you pointed out, I built the first solar house. And even then, and that was many years ago, we knew that this global warming was coming. And, you know, there wasn't any sign of it at the time, but people knew it was coming. And there were jokes like, you know, are we going to be choking are we going to go to the Rocky Mountains and be gasping for air because the tide's after it? Well, that's a super exaggeration, but it is real. But the thing is, there's the two sides of it. As I pointed out, there's the economics of producing fuel without needing fossil fuel. And, you know, some investors might say they don't want to put their money in a wind tower that takes 10 years to pay off. But when you think about it, that's not bad. And when you've paid off that wind tower, and I don't know who owns it, it might belong to an individual, it might belong to a small community group, it doesn't have to belong to a huge grid. It can be owned locally, and the best ones are. But when that energy starts to be free, and, you know, the thing about the wind tower, what's the lifespan of the wind tower? Well, somebody says, well, gee, they're not going to last that long. Well, the Brooklyn Bridge was built 125 years ago. Go take a look at it. It's fine. The wind towers are going to be, you know, you might say, well, we're going to plan a lifespan of 25 years. Maybe. I say they're going to be, you know, they're going to get better, but they're going to be here for a long time, which means they're going to be putting out energy for a long time, and that energy is free. And one of the results that I see coming from that, you know, I know manufacturers will tell you that one of the things that deters them and even discourages them from coming to Rhode Island is that energy costs are a problem. But when we get over that hump, we can return to manufacturing. Mm-hmm. And there's no reason manufacturing can't happen here. We're centrally located. And, you know, are you familiar with Tolman High School?
Yes.
Which is in Pawtucket. And anybody, if you ever drive through Pawtucket, take a look at it. It's this incredible, beautiful, mm-hmm. huge brick building. I mean, Brown University doesn't even have a building like that. But the thing about Tolman High School that's important mm-hmm. to me is it was built in 1926. It was the biggest, most expensive high school ever built. Mm-hmm. East of the Mississippi. This is in Pawtucket, so stop and think about that for a second. The reason Tolman High School, the most expensive high school ever built, was built in Pawtucket was a very rich industrial mm-hmm. city. Why? And at one point, it might not have been 1926, it might have been the turn of the century, but Rhode Island was the richest state. Mm-hmm. And we're not talking about people in mansions in Newport. We're talking about everybody.
Yeah.
So the return of industry and the return to manufacturing is a huge incentive.
Now
so let's invest the money in that alternative energy system.
Now, would returning to manufacturing, would there be an issue? Would that go against your fighting climate change agenda?
Well, if the manufacturing is based on using clean energy, I think it's exactly the opposite. You know, if you bring in manufacturing and you're burning coal mm-hmm. to, you know, smelt iron and build automobiles, that could be a problem.
Yeah.
By the way, I don't know how many people realize that this is where locomotives used to be built.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know,
I just found that out this
and
year.
And, you know, of course, we're still building some of the, you know, a lot of people aren't too happy about mm-hmm. it, but we're building one of the most important things in the world, which is submarine hulls in Quonset.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they won the Cold War for us. Do we have too many of them? That's an issue. But we have the ability in this state, and we've got the talent to do some amazing stuff.
Yeah.
And we will benefit from it pretty soon.
So another thing that you've been vocal about are the PawSox. They're leaving. It's
a tragedy.
It's certainly culturally, absolutely is. The economics are what people are discussing. Stadiums in a number of cities have come under scrutiny over the past few years as not bringing what they have promised. Worcester got the stadium because they're going to build an $86 million stadium. The team will pay $36 million back over the next 30 years. And then Worcester will borrow $100.8 million to
construct. That's a lot of money.
Yeah, to construct the stadium.
So keep that money in mind. $108 million.
$100.8 million.
$100.8 million. Okay,
yeah.
So $100 million. $100.1 million.
And so they're going to take that, and that's from Boston Globe, and they're going to invest that money in the stadium and around. But they're not going to make any of the profits, even though they'll own the stadium. And of 10 economists that were asked about this plan, only one approved of it. So my question to you, with all that in mind,
you know, I like what you're saying, and I'll tell you why in a minute.
And well, you'll have the opportunity. With that in mind, I want to know: do you think that keeping the PawSox would have been a good deal under such conditions?
Well, you know, if I can just say something about that $100.8 million, that's a lot of money,
mm-hmm.
and Worcester is a smaller population area than Providence, Pawtucket.
Mm-hmm.
They've got to sit down at their city council, and now they're going to have to choke that one down.
Mm-hmm.
And that might not happen, and Larry Lucchino knows that. So he thinks, I mean, he knows, he did his press conference, they're moving to Worcester, but I'm not sure that it's going to go that smoothly. In other words, they're going to have to deal with all the issues we dealt with. So let's set that aside for a second. We've done some things that were really bad in this state, and 38 Studios is one of them, and it really does tie. And everybody talks about this, the talk shows. But people have lost confidence. They've been betrayed by the governor, by Governor Raimondo, with the pension fund, you know, sending it to Wall mm-hmm. Street. They've been betrayed by 38 Studios. The legislature didn't stand up for them. We're paying this. We're paying to sweep it under the rug year after year after year. We're paying this bond issue. Which we don't even have to do. So people are just so disgusted. They've been betrayed. They don't trust their leadership. And, of course, the only way they get back, or the only way they, you know, they can be heard is by saying, tackle the Paw Sox. You know, we're not willing to, we don't want to spend anything on the Paw Sox. Mm-hmm. But I think if we could clear up some of those other issues, I think people might take a, you know, a slightly different view. And the other thing about it is that if it's going to be a bond issue, it's got to be on the ballot. One of the problems with the 38 Studios issue or question was, or problem was, that it was based on so-called moral obligation bonds. These are flat-out illegal in the Rhode Island Constitution. You look at the Constitution, Article 6, Section 16, you can't borrow money in Rhode Island over $50,000, which means a bond issue. Mm-hmm. You can't do that unless the people vote for it. And you can name it something like apple pie bonds or moral obligation bonds or Pawtucket high-risk bonds or Paw Sox bonds. It doesn't change it. It's against the law. Now, nobody's enforcing that law. It should be. I tried to. I tried to get some attorneys to sue the state. I couldn't get it done. But I'm coming back at it, you know, in it from a different direction. But, you know, the essence of the problem is people are just so disgusted with mm-hmm. leadership in 38 Studios that they've taken the Paw Sox as a kind of a form of debate. But if the deal could have been put together, and maybe deal's not even a good mm-hmm. word because it's taken on some bad connotations, but if that deal could be put together and if it were put to the voters, you know, and maybe as governor, if I thought it was a good idea, or Mayor Grebian, we would say, this is what we like about it. Please vote for it. They go in November, they vote it up or down. I have a feeling it would pass. It might be 51%. But, you know, like any other bond issue, they get to choose. The problem is, as I see it, that the governor never stepped in and negotiated something. And what the governor should have done, mm-hmm. Gina Raimondo, she should have sat down with Larry Lucchino, or somebody representing the Paw Sox, somebody who can make a decision and put all the cards on the table. Now, when you're negotiating, you don't tell everything that happens every day. But when you're done, you've got to show the people everything that you're proposing mm-hmm. and lay it out there so they can see everything. Who owns every block, every house, every empty building within X number of miles of that stadium? Because that's going to be part of the picture on how the profit's made. So you work something out, and then, you know, I would say, if you're Larry Lucchino, I'd say, you know, Larry, do you really need that much money in the stadium? Can you put off some of it till next year? And there are a lot of benefits to staying in Rhode Island. So do we really want to ask the people of Rhode Island for $40 million or $43 million? Mm-hmm. Couldn't we do it for $18? And he might say, well, you know, yeah, we could. And, maybe the deal includes the fact that there's some real estate benefits in the neighborhood. Who knows? Whatever it is, it needs to be 100% cards all out on the table, mm-hmm. and then it's got to go to the voters. Mm-hmm. Especially, you know, if they don't have any interest in it or some issue that they're not concerned with in the budget, well, that doesn't go to the voters. Mm-hmm. But if it's something like this, it's a bond issue, got to vote to go to the voters. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't be a bit surprised if it passed. And if it had passed, Pawtucket would be so much better off. They need the urban renewal, and, you know, I think the rest of us, we need the Paw Sox.
Mm-hmm. So another issue that's been in the news recently, immigration related, Rhode Island Latinos, who do make up the bulk of new immigration in the state, in terms of education, they have one of the largest achievement gaps between Latino and white students.
The largest in the country.
Yeah, learners are dead last for mathematics in eighth grade. The Roger Williams Latino Policy Institute has recommended several things, including increasing the number of Latino educators in Rhode Island schools, which are now around 1-3% of the staff. What do you think should be done in order to address this particular issue for Latino communities?
You know, it's an interesting thing that you would ask that question, because that's an important part of my platform. Mm-hmm. I think the first point I want to make is that we have an urban area which consists of part of Providence mm-hmm. and Pawtucket and Central Falls. Mm-hmm. And the kids in that area are referred to by educators as at-risk kids. And it's mm-hmm. not just Latinos, but it's all the kids. Mm-hmm. Granted that Latinos are a large portion of that, and that ELL is an issue that makes it a challenge. But I think the important key here is that this is a metropolitan area, and the metropolitan area has responsibilities or a burden or a task ahead of it which some other areas don't have. And the whole state... And we don't, unfortunately, own the part of Massachusetts that's right next to the city, and mm-hmm. because essentially we are their metropolitan too, mm-hmm. area too, Swansea and so on. But the point is that the whole state needs to step up to the plate and deal with the Providence education issues. You know, and that's one general point. And it does tie in also to the Providence bankruptcy, which is not your question, but nonetheless, you've got to keep that in mind. Education costs in Providence relate to the Providence, the impending and Providence bankruptcy issue, which a lot of people, including other candidates for governor, aren't interested in talking about. So, number one, we have to realize that the city has a responsibility, and we have what amounts to a financial responsibility. So, because some of the things that you're talking about are going to cost some money. There are a couple of education theories that I have, that I would like to point to. Something they did in Oklahoma, mm-hmm. maybe some years ago, I think it was the late 90s, they changed the profile of how they do education. Elementary schools in Oklahoma, kids start at age 4. Mm-hmm. And probably most people know this, and if you're a teacher, you certainly would know this. And by the way, everything I know about this has come from teachers explaining this to me. I'm mm-hmm. not inventing this stuff. I'm not claiming credit for it. Mm-hmm. This is what common sense teachers have told me. But if you don't have good arithmetic and reading skills by the end of third grade, you're not going to make it in high school chemistry, period. And that means you're not going to have the opportunity to be a pharmacist or mm-hmm. go to URI and be an engineer or many of those other. Mm-hmm. So you've got to have that age 4 through third grade level. And that means pre-K, pre-pre-K, whatever it's called. They did it in Oklahoma. They put qualified teachers at that level. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's optional. They're not out with truant officers dragging in every 4-year-old, but most of them benefit from it, take part in it, and the test scores have, the actual testing has changed. It's been worth the outcome, worth mm-hmm. the investment. And to me, I think it would be worth doing. Now, to do it statewide, number one, it is something of an experiment, even though we know it worked in Oklahoma. But to do it statewide would be expensive. So I'm proposing that we set up some kind of a test district, which would mm-hmm. be either Providence or part of Providence, along with Pawtucket and Central mm-hmm. Falls, and address those issues. A second interesting thing, and of course, as you say, we may need some ELL certified or specialized people. In other words, you're going to have to, you know, confront the fact that we do have language issues. Mm-hmm. And if you get... You know, if you get over a certain percentage of kids with say Spanish instead of English, they're not going to learn from the kids that speak English. So this is a challenge. Mm-hmm. You know, it'll take many more generations than it needs to. So we have to deal with this. But there's another thing that I want to remind people of, which was very much talked about by teachers a few years ago. A book called Finnish Lessons, and it's about what Finland did. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of interesting because they did five things, and they were essentially an agricultural economy where kids basically got out of school in the fifth grade and that was it. You know, they were working on the farm, that was all they needed. Mm-hmm. And they made a conscious decision as a country to become an advanced industrial country as opposed to an agricultural country. So they adopted this program. And what's interesting about it is it worked. But the five things, if I can remember them all. Number one, pay teachers like doctors. Number two, minimize testing. You know, they do testing and they compare, but they don't make a big deal out of it. Number three, very little homework. I mean, the kids are going to love this. Number four, plenty of recess. Mm-hmm. And number five, all public schools. So now Finland is Finland and Rhode Island is different. But I think we can learn from that. And anybody, you know, get that book, Finnish Lessons, read it. Mm-hmm. It explains a lot of what they did. I think we should adopt some of that. Mm-hmm. And I think if we did, and we did it in what you could see as a consolidated laboratory district, mm-hmm. as I said, Providence, Pawtucket, Central Falls, we could see some results. Now, somebody's going to say, somebody down in Westerly is going to say, well, wait a minute, why are you doing this up there when we should have it too? We need it. Well, of course you do. But this is an area where we need it a lot. Mm-hmm. And not only that, it's something that it's like a test case. And I think the state as a whole needs to step up and spend the money and do that. And mm-hmm. I think we would see outcome. And think of the benefits. I mean, instead of leaving third grade unable to ever take chemistry in high school, mm-hmm. they could take chemistry in high school, and you know, you can just imagine what they then they get to go to college and they get to be part of an industrial or a prosperous economy, mm-hmm. technological economy. Mm-hmm. Who wouldn't want that? And when you consider that as the outcome, mm-hmm. why wouldn't that be a good investment?
So I'm going to move on to my last two questions just in the interest of time. One of them is recently the state of Rhode Island, as well as the cities of Providence and Central Falls, have sued the Justice Department over JAG funding, Justice Assistance Grants, for those who don't know. And pretty much what happened is for fiscal year 2017, the DOJ forced a new requirement on cities that have been accepting this grant for many decades, that they certify that they are following current immigration law, and that be certified by the city's executive officer and the city's solicitor, and state in the case of Rhode Island as well. So the state of Rhode Island and those two cities are suing. Several other cities in Rhode Island have said they've accepted this. How do you feel about that? Because many law enforcement officers say, if you force us to commit to that particular part of it, that's going to make our job a lot harder, gaining trust within the communities we work.
You know, I'm not as familiar with the specific lawsuits mm-hmm. that you're talking about as I wish I were, as I'd like to be. But I think I get the general question. Mm-hmm. And I think the best, and I've thought a lot about this, we don't determine immigration at the state level. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're here and our economy benefits from it or is challenged by it or both at the mm-hmm. same time. But it's not something that we are, it's just the world we live in. Mm-hmm. My philosophy about dealing with difficult questions is you don't paint a target on your back, you don't go looking for trouble. And sometimes the answer is you find the solution or you find the resolution or the remedy without making it a fight. You know, and sort of comes to mind that, there's this great book that was written centuries ago by Sun Tzu, and it's called The Art of War. Mm-hmm. And the first rule in The Art of War is don't go to war. Mm-hmm. And my approach to that would be similar. We're not involved. We're not interested in having a fight with the federal government about anything. But so it's what it is. On the other hand, there are some things we can do. We can establish regional approaches to things. We can get, say, a conference of Northern New England governors. And there's some issues, there's some things that we can do to encourage, say, a quick resolution to citizenship issues. I think that's something that's really important. And that's something that I think that we could do on a regional level. Now, that doesn't mean that it's going to, that the region's going to, that the tail's going to wag the dog, but I think we can have influence. We can say, look, we've got some people who want to be citizens, or we've got some unresolved citizenship issues. Let's confront them, and let's confront them as a region rather than as one little state. Or, we send our Congress people and our senators to Washington, and effectively, nothing's happening. We're not getting a positive resolution, and we're not getting anything. But it is something, and I think once you've accepted the economic participation of somebody, mm-hmm. you owe them something. And to put it very simply, if Jose is on my roof nailing shingles, I can't ship him out of town the next day. We've had a transaction, we're part of the same community, and we need to work, we need to solve the problem in a way that doesn't involve hostility. And I think a governor is in a position to do that, maybe even more, say, than a congressional member. So I would see a regional conference. And there are other issues like licenses. I don't know if that's one of your next questions.
That would be, yeah.
Okay. But let's not make it a fight, because we're going to lose that fight. And if we don't lose the fight, we're going to split ourselves in half. There's no need for that. Why don't we start doing what certain other countries do? We can have international driver's licenses, or we can have regional driver's licenses. We can have the Massachusetts, New Hampshire, Maine, and Rhode Island regional driver's license. Of course, you're going to have to test people. You've got to make sure they know how to drive. But, my point is that there are creative ways to address these problems that don't make them, make them worse than they are.
So following that particular train of thought, I've been going down to a lot of these
communities. But a state of 1 million people does not go to war against the federal government of the United States. And, we're not going to win, and it's only going to, might score some political points, but it really isn't going to accomplish anything.
Well, I should.
And I want real accomplishments.
Well, I should point out that in that particular lawsuit, the state of Rhode Island's not alone. Their injunction with New York, Connecticut, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, New Jersey, Washington, and other places.
But that's a lawsuit as opposed to a resolution.
I'm talking about the JAG.
Right. That's in effect going to war with the government.
What are your positions on sanctuary states and cities?
Well, that in effect, my answer is, that is the question I was addressing. Why do you paint a target on yourself? Why do you go to war with the federal government? Instead, let's find a creative way to address the issue. We have, pick a number, are there 50,000 people living in Providence that have immigration issues? I'm not sure what the number is. It might be 20,000. I don't know. But are they going to be shipped out? No, of course not. They're our neighbors. And they're part of our economy. So that part, that's not on the table. So what can we do? Is Washington going to resolve the issue of their citizenship? Well, they're not doing it. So what can we do? Build a wall around Rhode Island or put up some fences or send some bad messages to Washington? I feel as though that is conflict for the sake of making political statements. Mm-hmm. And I would like to say, what's the outcome that we want to see? Short term, maybe some type of driver's license situation. And we can't just say, okay, only alien free, go to the registry. That doesn't satisfy the people in District 15, if you want to put it very mildly. But there is, let's think about it. Let's find a consensus and let's do something that everybody can be happy with. Mm-hmm. And I think that's possible. And it may be a couple of years after that that we've got the problem and there aren't any people who have citizenship issues at all. Those issues have been resolved, and then by that time the license issues aren't even, people have forgotten it. Mm-hmm. But I don't see it as a question of confronting the federal government in a hostile way just to make points politically with either side of the issue.
So on to my last question. This is something that I've been curious about as I drive around the state. I've seen one billboard for you, and I've seen several for Mr. Fung and Mrs. Raimundo, and same with the yard signs. So you've had a somewhat lower profile than other candidates. So I'm curious as to whether that's part of your political philosophy, or what's the modus operandi?
I guess your question is, why don't I have more name recognition? And if I'm serious about running, wouldn't I have addressed that or something?
Something to that measure.
And I have to admit, I've enjoyed being anonymous most of my life. Mm-hmm. And when I was a state representative, maybe I had 10,000 or 15,000 people living in the district I represented, but it wasn't necessary for me to be known in other districts, while I was a state representative. And a lot of the time, you can get more done if people don't notice you. This is different, so it's going to require some habits changing. By the way, there are two billboards out there, one in Pawtucket, one on the south. Okay. I don't know which one you've seen.
It was on 95 somewhere.
Well, okay.
Yeah.
And I am doing, if you turn on, a lot of people listen to WPRO, I'm going to have a presence there. It's already started. I don't have $7 million, and one of the issues to me should be, should these elections be about the content of your character, mm-hmm. or should they be about the content of your campaign fund? And I think, I'm asking the voters to make that decision. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, Gina Raimundo, she may have collected $7 or $8 million, if that's even possible, but she spent a couple of million of it recently, and she hasn't moved the needle. So it's not working. And in effect, she's got name recognition. Mm-hmm. I need to buy name recognition. You're helping me. But I can't afford, anything. I'm spending, who knows what it's going to be. But let's just say it's the price of a new truck. Mm-hmm. And my old truck's 2 years old, so, I'm fine. I'll be fine. Yeah. But I think that's part of the issue in the campaign. And the issue is Washington, are laws in Washington being bought by billionaire lobbyists or billionaire industrialists or capitalists, whatever, finance people? And they are. And that's not good for our country as a country. It's not good for us as individuals. It's happening on the state level. And at some point, I hope that the people are going to turn around and say, we've had enough of this, and I don't care. And, you know, and I had a talk show host ask me recently, and you're a print journalist, but this is sort of like a talk show, but he said to me, I'm not going to ask you what's in your campaign fund because I don't care. I'm not going to ask you what your polls are because I don't care. I want to know what kind of a governor you'd make. And I thought, wow, wouldn't that be a great model for all talk shows or all media? Rather than, you know, say, well, so-and-so's not a candidate because... But your question about how much money I have, you didn't make that, you didn't ask that question. You asked about my name recognition. Yeah. I've got to work on it. I admit that. What I don't bring with me is 8 years of terrible mistakes that Gina Raimondo has made, and some of those mistakes might be intentional because when a smart person makes a mistake, you don't necessarily let them off the hook for it because she's too smart to be making mistakes. She's lifted almost $1 billion from state employees and, you know, public employees and teachers, retired and active. So that she got her name recognition doing something that I wouldn't do. My other opponent in this primary, and we'll have to admit it's Matt Brown, he comes back here, he brings some charisma. He did some stuff that I hope you as a journalist will check into in 2006, which disqualified him, in my mind, as a candidate. I couldn't support him because I'm looking for somebody that's going to resolve the money in politics issues. And as you may know, he devised a very elaborate scheme for campaign for laundering his campaign financing. People who were going to give money had maxed out, and he set up a deal with Hawaii, Massachusetts, and Maine, and he copped a plea, and he's basically not even telling the truth now. He's making it sound like there wasn't an issue. They let him off, and he made a deal. We knew that in 2006 because it was in the newspaper. You don't have to be a genius to see what you're... So I guess that, you know, I am suffering from lack of name recognition, but it's not discouraging me. And who knows, you know, maybe I'll catch up. But from my point of view, I think I've got something to bring. I did the apprenticeship. You know, somebody said the state needs a mechanic. Maybe I'm the mechanic. Maybe I know how to work the tire machine. Maybe I know how to work the lift and grease and oil the car, change the oil. And maybe I'm the one that can make this happen and bring consensus on some of these immigration issues like you were talking about. Should I be disqualified just because I'm starting from, you know, from behind a little bit? Or do you as a journalist plus the voters enter into it and maybe make a decision? I don't know the outcome. I do know my own philosophy, my personal philosophy is the voters are always right. And on the 13th of September, I'm cleaning out my headquarters, win or lose. If I win, I'm going to need a bigger headquarters. If I lose, I don't need it at all. On the 14th, I'm either going to start taking phone calls or I'm going to paint my house. I'm fine either way. But I am asking you, you know, to the voters now, I'm asking you, I need your vote. And I'm asking for this job. But I've noticed the voters have great wisdom and they'll know the right answer.
Well, I was about to give you an opportunity to do a one-minute elevator pitch, but I believe you took the opportunity to do that yourself. With all that said...
Well, you're a very patient journalist. You're very patient. I mean, I tend to run on, but...
I'm used to it.
We talk.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, Mr. Dickinson, I would like to thank you for taking the time of your Thursday evening to come and speak with me. And no matter who you vote for, listeners, remember to get out there and vote. All right.
Thank you very much, Kevin.